I arrived in New York City for the first time on a college sojourn from Michigan in September 1978 for an internship at the United Nations and a chance to explore Christopher Street, the mountaintop of gay life. At 19, I was not yet comfortable with the longings of my heart, but Manhattan struck me as a city of promise, at once grimy and magical, an enormous, thrilling place where people could hide and be found. I committed to both city and self after collecting my degree in June 1981. My college roommate Brian Goujon and I took up in a tiny one-room apartment in Midtown, sleeping chastely on opposite edges of a narrow, lumpy bed. Goujon had grown up in a large Catholic family in a rural part of Michigan, yet he possessed an innate cosmopolitan sensibility, which I lacked thoroughly, an easiness with being gay and a strong ambition as an artist. I envied Goujon's ability to create beauty from nothing, which suited our finances. On our walls, he hung his paintings, mostly of faraway places he'd only imagined. One featured pyramids and palm trees, which he titled Egypt. Another depicted an idealized living room scene. He called this one home, though in significant ways he had never truly felt at home, nor had I, not until getting to New York. We were part of the largest influx of gay men and lesbians in New York's history, a vast gay reverse diaspora, born into exile and separated from our own kind. We were reassembling in a place that had only existed in the imagination, the new city of friends conjured by Walt Whitman 100 years before. Home was an ambition as fanciful as the pyramids. Our timing was unfortunate. Just 2 weeks after unpacking, on the Friday of the long July 4th weekend, the New York Times carried the first news of the plague. "Rare cancer seen in 41 homosexuals," ran the headline. The cases were concentrated in Manhattan, with a few in the San Francisco Bay Area as well, and consisted of violet-colored spots appearing somewhere on the body, easily mistaken for bruises, though they were sometimes raised and textured. The cancer was not just skin deep. It killed by spreading to the lung, liver, or spleen. 1 in 5 was already dead. The article noted that most cases had involved homosexual men who have had multiple and frequent sexual encounters with different partners, as many as 10 sexual encounters each night up to 4 times a week. Many of the patients have also been treated for viral infections, such as herpes, cytomegalovirus, and hepatitis B, as well as parasitic infections, such as amebiasis and giardiasis. Many patients also reported that they had used drugs, such as amyl nitrite and LSD, to heighten sexual pleasure. I later learned that men who read the paper on the ferries to Fire Island that day, having immediately recognized themselves in those demographics, spent the long weekend examining one another's flesh. They found purple lesions by the dozens. It was possible to stand on those boardwalks and pool decks and beaches that weekend and foretell the whole terrible future. But none of the signs appeared among our new acquaintances in the city. We thought for a while that our economic marginality put us out of reach even from this. What became a disease of the poor began by assaulting the gay bourgeoisie, the beautiful people of the Fire Island Pines, as a popular ad described the niche. Although a doctor in the article called the outbreak rather devastating, I was more annoyed than alarmed by the news. The story seemed like a new slander on the gay community, which had existed cohesively for barely more than a decade since the Stonewall riots in 1969. Every advance since then was met by an extreme and paranoiac counterforce. The 1970s produced the fiercest round of anti-gay legislation the nation had ever known, hammered into place in the name of protecting children of all things from us. Dozens of states and cities adopted measures preemptively blocking gay rights ordinances. Anita Bryant, a Miss America runner-up and the movement's obstreperous leader, still exercised considerable national influence on the July morning when the rare cancer story hit. It was impossible to read the news outside of this context. It seemed like just another lie, a call to more hatred, a fiercer backlash. Anyone could see prejudice in what news of us was or was not being covered. On the day in 1980, that the U.S. Senate candidates John Lindsay, Bess Meyerson, and Elizabeth Holtzman debated their gay rights planks before a citywide gay Democratic club, a first in history and the suggestion of coming political clout. The Times instead ran a story entitled, "Restroom Shut to Foreclose Use by Homosexuals," the toilet in question being in suburban Westchester County. A few months later came one of the most hideous anti-gay crimes in the nation's history, when a madman drove through the village, emptying a submachine gun into crowds of gay men. He killed two and seriously injured seven. For the community, it was a devastating watershed. For the Times, it merited a few paragraphs inside, with no mention of other rampages in the weeks and months leading up to it, no quotes from advocates, no elegiac background stories about the victims, and no follow-up coverage in the coming days of the large candlelight vigil for the victims outside St. Vincent's Medical Center, or the community's two memorial services that drew thousands and thousands of gay men and lesbians.